Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week, The Guardian ran a series of stories which exposed a wide-ranging secret court order that demanded Verizon pass the details of phone calls to the NSA. Other stories included details of a massive NSA intelligence system called PRISM, which collects data from the systems of technology companies like Microsoft, Apple, Google, Yahoo, and Facebook. We have since learned that the leaks came from 29-year-old Edward Snowden, a former technical assistant for the CIA, an employee of the private contractor Booz Allen Hamilton. Booz Allen has since fired Snowden. In an interview with The Guardian's Glenn Greenwald, Snowden said that his main objective was to inform the public. According to The Guardian, the Obama administration has offered no indication about what it plans to do about Snowden, other than to say that his case has been referred to the Justice Department. Snowden is currently in Hong Kong, where he gave a lengthy interview to Glenn Greenwald about why he made those leaks. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about these programs and President Obama's overall record on civil liberties. During the president's 2008 campaign, he promised to reduce civil liberties violations being committed in the name of national security. He said the Bush administration, quote, acts like violating civil liberties is a way to enhance our security. It is not. There are no shortcuts to protecting America, end quote. Well, after these reports were exposed and these programs were exposed, the president defended mass surveillance in the name of security. So, what does this mean exactly? Who's really calling the shots here? And what power does the government have? Also, what explains its close relationship with technology companies? Today, we're joined by Kurt Opsahl, senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, where he focuses on free speech, civil liberties, and privacy. He's co-author of the Electronic Media and Privacy Law Handbook, and he joins us from his office in San Francisco. Hi, Kurt. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild and author of the book Spying on Democracy, A Short History of Government Corporate Collusion in the Technology Age. Heidi co-hosts a weekly radio show on civil liberties called Law and Disorder, and it airs on WBAI in New York. Hi, Heidi. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. And Eli Clifton is a reporter covering national security and foreign policy at the American Independent News Network, and he's joining us from New York. Hi, Eli. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. So, Kurt, you're a senior staff attorney at the EFF. First off, what was your initial reaction when you read these series of Guardian articles?
Well, I was, we have been suing over the surveillance for many years, and it was interesting to see the hard documentary proof of some aspects of the surveillance and bring this back into the national conversation.
What was new about these latest reports?
Well, there had been reports previously that, for example, Verizon was participating in a call detail records program. But the government, in responding to some of these reports, had said that their program was one-end foreign or foreign-to-foreign. It did not include domestic-to-domestic. And there we saw in the Verizon order in black and white that it did include domestic-to-domestic, including local calls.
And we'll talk more about the details throughout the show. Heidi, you focus on this regularly. You have a radio show about these issues. What was your response when you read these articles?
Well, I was greatly heartened because I think what has been shown is the close collaboration between government and corporations who are increasingly doing the government's business of intelligence gathering. And I think the fact that Booz Allen was the contractor involved and a man of conscience spoke out because he saw that our government was violating our Fourth Amendment to be free from reasonable search and seizures, is surprising to a lot of people, but not surprising to people who have been following this progression over the last two administrations.
Well, that's interesting, and we'll talk about the close relationship with the tech companies. But in terms of the private contractors, Chris Pyle was on Democracy Now! This morning. He's a former military instructor who exposed the CIA and Army's monitoring of millions of Americans back in the 70s. And on today's program, he said 70% of the intelligence budget of the United States today goes to private contractors like Booz Allen. He says, quote, "This is a major change in the power of surveillance. It now goes not only to the government, but to private corporations," end quote. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, the problem with that, and those statistics have been cited frequently, is that the government is accountable to the Constitution. Private corporations are accountable to their shareholders. And I think this working relationship runs the risk that surveillance operations and related investigations will really serve to privilege those in power over the rights of ordinary people. And there's a possibility that influence and support from corporations will interfere with the integrity and the impartiality of law enforcement undertakings. We've seen how contractors, military contractors abroad, such as Kaki, have been held to be immune from lawsuits when they do things like kill or injure Rachel Corrie, the activist, is one example. So I think it gets the government, they use the corporations almost as a proxy to do their work without accountability.
And Rachel Corrie is the activist who was killed by a bulldozer in the West Bank. It was a Caterpillar bulldozer.
Right.
You know, to this point, Eli, I mean, as a reporter, what really struck you about the latest series of reports?
Well, in terms of the reports coming out themselves and what we learned from them, I think the thing that really struck me, and really a lot of us who had been trying to monitor this over the past several years, is that while we knew roughly what the legal framework was through which they can gather this intelligence, and we even had some notions, obviously, the NSA puts a great deal of resources, both themselves as well as through contractors, into signal intelligence. The scale at which this was able to operate really was reflecting a new era, both of technological capabilities as well as the government's interest in doing so, in acquiring the sheer scale of data that was being seemed to have been under review, as well as the ability to sort the data. Because the fact that you get it doesn't necessarily mean you'll have the capability to do anything with it. But this boundless informant tool seems to suggest that there was a fairly advanced system for processing really large scale amount of data. The other thing that really stuck out was the statement that the system was able to tell with a 51% certainty whether data it had acquired was domestic or foreign, and that really was a disturbing number to hear. And I think a lot of us, when we saw that, questioned whether the system was quite as advanced as they said it was in terms of being able to stay on the right side of the law.
Well, and we'll also talk today about international implications. But before we do that, Kurt, again, the EFF has sued over surveillance for many years. Who's really behind these programs? I mean, can you give us a sense of who makes these decisions? Does the president, you know, have meetings and say, we need to start working with Facebook, Yahoo, and Google and get information? I mean, talk about how this process actually works.
Well, I mean, the program began in the Bush administration in the wake of the 9/11 attacks. And it was coordinated largely by David Addington and Dick Cheney, providing some of the legal frameworks and going to Michael Hayden at the NSA to come up with a new way of using the tremendous technical capacity of the NSA, along with a much broader view of the legalities. And then the program continued on over the years with them trying to add additional capacity. So one of the, you know, telephone companies, of course, were getting involved, and that was a lot of the news back in our first lawsuit was against AT&T for their cooperation and collaboration with the program. But Congress passed retroactive immunity. With some of the corporations that we're seeing getting involved these days, it seems to be, this is coming from Section 702 request under the FISA Amendment Acts. So that does put the companies in a different bind than the telecoms were in for the early aspects of the program, where there was no court order, where there was no statute, but they were pressured to cooperate, and only apparently Quest really stood up to them.
Is it safe to say that a lot of the people who worked on these programs under the Bush administration, you know, like longtime government employees, are still working on this under the Obama administration? People we probably never even heard of.
I mean, there's a lot of people who are career people at the NSA and within the Department of Defense and Department of Justice who have been working on these issues for many years. But the political appointees would have changed.
And so in terms of the Obama administration and his team, what role are they playing in all of this in terms of the decision-making process?
Well, I mean, I think really to highlight that we need further transparency to get to the bottom of these questions. I mean, we have some idea of who would have the type of role that would be involved in this, you know, the director of the NSA, the general counsel of the NSA, the general counsel of the FBI and director there, of course, people in the White House. But to actually know whose role, it took a lot of reporting and analysis before people realized, for example, the role that David Addington played in the Bush-Cheney administration as a senior advisor to Vice President Cheney. So I think it'll come out maybe more clearly over time.
And then, Heidi, what about oversight? Thomas Powers wrote a book called The Man Who Kept the Secrets, Richard Helms and the CIA. It's about the history of intelligence collection in the U.S. And he says, I am virtually certain no one in the White House actually knows what these programs do. They're just too big. They may think they know, but they do not. The White House officials who assure the public the program is closely monitored do not and cannot know that. He goes on to say, I very much doubt that anyone at the NSA actually knows what these programs do. They're too big. Each component of the program will have a director, and he or she will receive reports from various desks and offices, which in turn will monitor other desks and offices below them. But the person at the top will only know whether the people below them think they have a problem. Otherwise, all is well. Genuine oversight just cannot happen at this point. Do you agree with that?
I agree that is really at the crux of this whole problem. The country's leadership, with respect especially to the enormous outsourcing, does not have a complete grasp of the contracting workforce and the issues germane to outsourcing. And that was said by the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence in its 2008 Senate Intelligence Authorization Bill. Oversight is basic to holding our government accountable. The 9/11 Commission report and many others have cited the problem with a lack of intelligence coordination. That's why we had the creation of so-called fusion centers starting, I think, in 2005. Fusion centers are intended to help better coordinate various levels of intelligence gathering, and they bring in, tellingly, the private sector to do that. They also bring in the military, and that's something that harkens back, if people remember, to the 60s and 70s when the military was spying on political dissidents. They had a vast database, and it came out, and citizens were outraged. And, you know, protections were put in place to protect against that. It seems that now the military is one of the components. You know, the NSA was formed to help enable intelligence abroad, and now they're being an integral part of these intelligence efforts. And I think you're right, there are so many different levels and layers, and failure to coordinate and communicate, compounded with the metadata that's being gathered, makes it disturbing that accountability and knowledge by our leaders is sorely lacking.
Can you talk more about metadata and why that's important?
Well, one of the things about metadata, as I understand it, is that we're gathering blanket ranges of information, that hasn't yet been created, so that in terms of our system of justice, where reasonable suspicion or probable cause is based on something that has occurred and law enforcement goes to a court, which provides us a sense of checks and balances to make sure that there is reason to conduct and open an investigation. Now what we're doing is authorizing the collection of data that in some cases has yet to even be created. So there can be no probable cause or reasonable suspicion. And we're talking all kinds of, you know, images, emails, anything electronic, reflecting a massive shift, really, in how government is able to document everything that we're doing, both in real time and in stored data, which is another problem, because it means that down the road, if someone is outspoken politically, the government with their corporate partners can go back and look at our communications from years ago and try to build a case, often to really vilify and perhaps punish domestic dissidents.
That is Heidi Bogosian. She's executive director of the National Lawyers Guild and author of Spying on Democracy. Eli Clifton is a reporter covering national security and foreign policy at the American Independent News Network. And Kurt Opsahl is senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, co-author of the Electronic Media and Privacy Law Handbook. And today we are talking about the latest revelations about the NSA's various systems. One is PRISM, which collects data from the systems of tech companies. And then the other one involves court orders that demand Verizon pass details of phone calls to the NSA. And we'd love to hear from you. When you heard about these programs, what was your reaction? And what are your thoughts on this recent Pew study? 56% of Americans say the NSA program tracking telephone records is an acceptable way for the government to investigate terrorism. 41% say it's unacceptable. What are your thoughts about how people feel about surveillance? How do you feel about it? And what questions do you have about these issues and these programs? This is receiving so much media attention. What do you think is missing from the conversation, and what questions do you still have? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you work in a tech company, we'd also love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Kurt, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on metadata, just to give an understanding of what that is and why it matters. So metadata is the information about a communication other than the actual words spoken. So it's when you made a call, how long you spoke. In some cases, like cell phones, it would include location data. And the government, by collecting all of this metadata about calls, it is an extraordinarily invasive, even though it doesn't include the conversation, because it tells a complete story of what you're doing, who you're speaking to. They can put a map to your life. And you know, an example that you know you can look at, there would be, for example, if somebody calls, say their doctor speaks for a little while, and then calls to an abortion clinic, you might have an idea of what the conversation was in both those, even if you didn't listen in. Mm-hmm. If somebody is calling from the Golden Gate Bridge, their cell phone tracks them there, and they speak to a suicide prevention hotline, you don't need to listen to the conversation to know what they've talked about. So there's a lot of information that is embedded within metadata that reveals very intimate details of people's lives. But the government asserts that this information is not Fourth Amendment protected, that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to metadata.
So where does this information live? I mean, if it were to come back to haunt you in 5 years, who would have access to it and how would they get it?
So what General Alexander, the NSA director, said in testimony yesterday is that they store it and then they look at it to give them a way to go back in time. That was his words. You know, they look at somebody now. They say, okay, this person now is somebody who we want to investigate thoroughly, and we can go and look at everything that they've done for the last 5 years, who they've spoken with, how long they spoke. And how can it be used? It can be used if you have, like, a group or an association which is coming under government suspicion. You know, you're part of the Occupy movement, you're have a dissident group, or, you know, you're with the NAACP. You can go ahead and talk to all of your friends, but if you do so, and if any one of them comes under suspicion, then they'll get a map of the entire community.
And so is this information being shared with, for example, like state or local officials or police departments or companies?
As far as I know, it is not. I think there was such an effort to keep this program away from the eyes of the American people that it was held only at sort of the highest levels at the FBI and NSA, and then filtered down. So a lot of times where the FBI would get a lead that came from the program, they wouldn't know exactly where it came from. So this actually led to some complaints by the FBI that they were being put on useless missions You know, for example, there might be a pizza delivery shop, and everybody in a community seems to call them very often, and this starts to look suspicious to the NSA pattern analysis, that this is a, you know, the hub of a bunch of spokes. Well, of course, it's just the pizza delivery guy. But they give this as a tip to the FBI and send them to do further investigations.
But did Edward Snowden have access to all of this information?
Well, that's what he says he did. It's, you know, we're still trying to find out the details of what or how much access he did. But in his interview with The Guardian, he said that he had access to be able to task the PRISM system to get information from the government databases.
How, I mean, does this surprise you, Heidi, that a 29-year-old, a former technical assistant for the CIA, an employee of the private contractor Booz Allen Hamilton, had access to all of this information?
Well, in an ideal world, yes, it would be surprising. I think that, again, we've seen such an acceleration of anti-terrorism-related sort of expansion of what the government can do and lessening of protections safeguarding us from being spied on that it's not surprising. You know, one of the things that I think is a hallmark of the Obama administration is an increasingly secretive government, and yet one that is giving record numbers of security clearances to these contractors. And again, I think that lessens the amount of control, since these are not direct government personnel, but rather contractors. We don't know how they're conducting their operations and who has access to what data.
And what about you, Eli? What really strikes you about the Obama administration that makes it stand out from the Bush administration on these issues?
Well, I think the thing that really stands out is the fact that the continuation of so much that started under the Bush administration. This was an administration and a president that ran on changing so many of the things of what had gone on, especially following 9/11, the growing infringement on civil liberties, the expansion of the intelligence systems, both in the public and private sector, as we've certainly now seen with more clarity than ever before. And I think that's what's really striking, is that although running on this agenda of greater transparency and walking back some of these expansions, this administration hasn't seemed to have taken large steps in that direction. And I think that when we talk about, you mentioned the Pew poll data showing that, you know, a large number of Americans are actually comfortable with having phones under NSA surveillance, under the conditions that, well, that will help reduce the likelihood of another terror attack. And when we saw the NSA chief testify yesterday saying that this has helped stop dozens of threats against the United States, the language in which we talked about this really hasn't changed either. And it really is about, well, there's a clear trade-off, is the way it's presented, between privacy and security and preventing another terror attack. And part of this is based in this rhetoric of that the only acceptable amount of risk of terrorism is when we reduce it to 0%. And to get to that point, and when that's your goal, you do have to start making some rather uncomfortable trade-offs. And instead of framing the conversation and the national debate in the context of how can we keep ourselves secure while protecting civil liberties, because these things might even go together, that hasn't been the way the debate has changed. And certainly in Obama's second term, I don't think we've seen anything to suggest he was holding something back for a second term when perhaps he would find it more politically feasible.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, and I'd love to hear listeners on that question about, you know, why so many people feel comfortable with a program like this. 56%, some percentages say it's higher. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW San Francisco, a show that depends on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or you can post a comment or question on the website, yourcallradio.org, and that's where you can also sign up for the show's weekly email newsletter at kalw.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we will discuss media coverage of the NSA programs. We'll also talk about how the media are treating Glenn Greenwald, the Guardian columnist who broke the story, and Edward Snowden, the 29-year-old who leaked the story. We'll also discuss coverage of the ongoing protests in Turkey. And we'd love to hear from you on these programs. What questions do you have? This has received so much media attention, but we wanted to open the lines to find out if there's anything missing or if there's any pressing questions that you have been wanting reporters to bring up, and maybe they haven't. The international angle hasn't gotten that much attention, so we'll talk about that. Also, the connection between the United States government and technology companies really deserves more attention. We'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts on these various studies that look at how Americans view surveillance and why so many people say this is acceptable if it gives the government the tools it needs to investigate terrorism? What are your thoughts on that? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Eli Clifton is a reporter covering these issues for the American Independent News Network. Heidi Boghossian is Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild and author of Spying on Democracy. She co-hosts a weekly radio show called Law and Disorder on WBAI in New York. And Kurt Opsahl is a senior attorney, staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Kurt, I know we need to let you go, but before we do, what is your reaction to how the public has been responding to this? I mean, what I find fascinating is that, you know, some liberal groups and news organizations or, you know, people who work for them say that, well, we're not too concerned because it's happening under the Obama administration, but we'd really be concerned if a Republican had access to all of this in 2016.
Well, there has been a tremendous shift in public support on party lines between the Bush administration and Obama administration. And I think, you know, that comes to the notion that underlying this is trust your government. That's what they're saying, is that, you know, we have this tremendous power. We can look into your lives, but trust us, we will use it wisely. And some Republicans will trust a Republican administration to do that. Some Democrats will trust a Democratic administration. But it's not good civic hygiene. You don't want to have government to possess a power that is relying on you trusting that only good people will be in government. In order to have the kind of society that we want to build, a future that we want to live in, we need to have government power limited in manner so it doesn't matter who is in government, that they can't abuse citizens' rights.
And where does this go from here?
Well, I mean, our case is ongoing. There are several other cases that have been filed, so there will be one aspect that's going to go forward in the courts. In the legislature, there is hearings. What we've called for is a new church commission. The church commission was done in the 70s in the wake of Watergate and ConIntelPro and some of the other programs under the Nixon administration and even before that, and it exposed a lot of wrongdoing and led to an attempt at reform. And maybe it's time for Congress to do that again, get to the bottom of this, and really put some strict limits on the government's power.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Kurt.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. That's Kurt Opsahl, Senior Staff Attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. We have a related question from a listener who writes in, there are progressive lecture circuit lesser evilism diehards that claim that no matter how much we all hear in the progressive media about Barack Obama continuing Bush's policies and Barack Obama exceeding Bush's policies in domestic and foreign policy, that a Republican presidency would be far worse. But just as only a Republican president could first go to China, I believe that only a Democratic president could make it much easier for the state to institute, continue, or indeed exceed the kind of Republican administration policies like a Stasi-like domestic surveillance state that would spark mass outrage among liberals and progressives if indeed a Republican administration committed them. Heidi, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, we were all surprised, I think, when Obama was elected, made sweeping promises about having more transparency, more protection for whistleblowers. He was going to close Guantanamo. Instead, we've seen extrajudicial assassinations of American citizens, the use of drones, expansion of NSA surveillance, really codifying secret laws and very overbroad interpretations of what we need to do to protect the national security. We've seen increased prosecution of whistleblowers, even under the Espionage Act, and a coordination with the private sector to shut down free speech. I don't think that whether it is a Republican or Democratic administration is the measure of how we respond or should respond to this overreaching government. One of the trouble with a sweeping surveillance apparatus that we haven't talked about yet is the chilling effect, as it's called, on public discourse, so that when people are aware that their every move is being under surveillance, tracked, stored, perhaps used for different purposes, on a subconscious level, many will really curtail the way they converse, conduct emails, even their reading habits when they know that the government can get a secret subpoena or warrant to go in and find out what you're taking out from the library. And I think that people on one level will inevitably feel less comfortable saying what they really think. They curtail their speech, even if they think it's not what the government wants them to think. And the argument people keep saying is, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, so why should I mind being monitored? And I think that's very dangerous to democracy. You know, we say if you don't use your First Amendment protections and exercise First Amendment robust activities, you're going to lose those protections.
You know, I think you make such an interesting point. And Eli, as a reporter, how do you see this playing out on the streets when it comes to expressing dissent and protest? Because, you know, I've been following these various protests, even small ones, for the past, 4 years. And after Occupy, when people got their heads smashed in, and then, for example, a number of people were in D.C. protesting the fact that no bankers have gone to jail over the economic crisis. I mean, young women got tased. I mean, this has to have an effect. What are you seeing on the streets and how this affects people?
Well, I think the ongoing frustration is how the Justice Department has focused its efforts. And, you know, all of these surveillance mechanisms, and certainly there's fair ethical and legal questions about the fact that they even exist, but they do, and in the ways that the Justice Department has decided to pursue the most high-profile cases, it's gone after whistleblowers, it has not gone after bankers, it has not gone after the people who really in both political parties, I don't think it's a partisan thing necessarily, believe the Justice Department should be spending greater effort pursuing. And instead, we find out that the NSA has conducted this expanded surveillance program. The Justice Department appears to have been rubber stamping these requests to conduct surveillance. The FISA courts, I believe, have supposedly, according to some stories, not ever turned down a request, although certainly the requests themselves are often classified. I think that there's growing distrust in how this Justice Department has applied itself to upholding the Constitution and to pursuing an agenda of law enforcement that really we can all probably agree are important things to go after. And instead, it's applied itself with a great deal of effort and resources to protecting and expanding the surveillance systems that really were started under the past administration and have continued to be expanded under this one.
That's Eli Clifton, a reporter covering national security issues at the American Independent News Network. Heidi Boghossian is executive director of the National Lawyers Guild and author of Spying on Democracy. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about the NSA programs, and we've got a number of calls. Let's hear from Joseph in San Francisco. Hi, Joseph.
Hey, Rose. How are you this morning?
Good, thank you.
Okay, good. I would like to hearken back in history, get a little perspective. I could recall a guy by the name of Daniel Ellsberg in the Pentagon Papers. He was deemed the most dangerous man in America. But aside from him, there was a little bit of a thing called COINTELPRO. And at the height of COINTELPRO during the 60s and 70s, they focused on dissent, political dissent, folks against the war, the Black Panther Party, and most specifically regarding Black Panther Party, at its height, there were only 5,000 members nationwide, and they were considered a hate group and a terrorist group, and COINTELPRO did break the back of that movement, as well as many others. Can someone comment on COINTELPRO, and if we are experiencing now, is a carryover from COINTELPRO?
Yeah, thank you. And what are the differences? What are your thoughts, Heidi?
Well, definitely this, I sometimes refer to it as the new COINTELPRO. COINTELPRO was marked by a series of secret, covert programs aimed at United States citizens and organizations that the government deemed either subversive or somehow dangerous to the national security. And those included the Black Panthers, Martin Luther King Jr., many others, peace organizations. And the problem was that in addition to monitoring these individuals and organizations, COINTELPRO was characterized really by a series of very dark operations aimed at discrediting and destroying these organizations and individuals. Fred Hampton, the Black Panther, was murdered. Many others suffered in different ways. But when the public found out about it, and it was after several individuals broke into the offices of one of the FBI bureaus in Pennsylvania, I think, made it public, legislators said, oh, you know, we have to distance ourselves from this shameless thing, and they ended the program. Then what happened was a series of protections were put in place to curb the manner that the FBI could spy on domestic, either dissidents and or just individuals who might be outspoken in their viewpoints. Over the years, and especially accelerated after the events of 9/11, those protections, some of which are called consent decrees or court settlements where a local police department can't spy on religious or political groups, those protections have been lessened. Much as Section 215 of the USA Patriot Act allows the FBI to order any person or entity to turn over so-called tangible things, as long as the FBI says it's for an authorized investigation to protect against international terrorism or clandestine intelligence activities. And I think the problem with that, the lessening of protections and really giving a carte blanche to intelligence agencies to open investigations without probable cause based on their word that it might relate to international terrorism, is that it is obviously ripe for abuse. And that's why we need clear-cut limits to how the FBI can spy on individuals in this country so that they're not abused. It's not up to the whimsy of a particular FBI agent who doesn't like what someone says. So I think we're seeing what I would call a return to COINTELPRO-esque activities, definitely.
Eli?
I think that a lot of what we're seeing here, and I think it's important to look at both the similarities and the differences with COINTELPRO. And I think in some ways this is more disturbing in the long run. So to start with, I'd say that, well, so far it is different than COINTELPRO in that we haven't yet heard allegations that there were specific political groups or individuals targeted within the United States because of membership in active, I guess, non-terrorist, although that's written very large now, organizations within the domestic United States. However, the methods that are being used now are really far more sweeping than what we saw in COINTELPRO, which were a series of targeted wiretaps as well as other surveillance operations. But it was limited by the technology back then. Now what we have is a surveillance system that really is capable of collecting this metadata from pretty much every single person in the country and abroad, as well as the ability to very quickly harvest internet data, potentially phone conversations, from a centralized location. And as I say, this notion of that they're acquiring more information, according to the allegation that Snowden is bringing forward, acquiring more data than they have necessarily warrants for, but with the understanding that they aren't going to look at certain data until they receive authorization to do so. So the difference now is they can just aggregate this. It's a collection of huge amounts of intelligence data, and all it takes is, in theory, a signature on a piece of paper to go in and look with far more scrutiny at communications, domestic communications.
All right. Well, thank you again for the call, Joseph. Why don't we take a few, we have a number of callers, so why don't we take a few in a row, and then we'll get responses from Heidi and Eli. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Hi, Rose. Good morning. At this point, my comment is probably a little redundant on a program like this, which identifies like a major problem with this program right away, which is that it can be used to target political speech. You know, you asked earlier why it is that a lot of Americans seem to be satisfied with this program, and I would argue that people who don't listen to a program like this are only treated to two possibilities. One is you are either a terrorist, in which case the government is justified in eavesdropping on you, or you're not. You're doing nothing wrong, and then in that case, the government has no interest in eavesdropping on you. But there's a third, and there are other possibilities that the mainstream media doesn't identify, which is, for instance, political speech. And, you know, a number of your guests and callers have pointed this out, but basically, you can imagine other situations like, oh, for instance, say a group plans to protest an upcoming presidential convention. Then surveillance like this could be used to identify that group, say, raid the house, disrupt the speech, the political speech that would have taken place, and then no charges are ever filed, but the diminishing of free speech has already occurred. So it's just an observation. You've already identified this, but those are my thoughts.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And Alternet actually had a story last week about Occupy and how their phone calls were monitored. So thank you. We'll ask our guests about that in just a couple minutes. And be sure to tune in tomorrow because we'll definitely talk about media coverage of all of this. Let's go to Eileen in Mountain View. Hi, Eileen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about nodes. It looks to me from reading like the software that they have will show collections of calls in one place. And I wondered if they could, you kind of touched on this, I wondered if they could identify groups that way. I mean, authoritarian governments in the past have really not stopped to ask whether this particular gypsy or gay person or socialist or Jewish person was a really good, loyal person. They just identify groups. So I'm wondering if this might have a chilling effect on all of our communications since most of us belong to some kind of group or another. Thank you for taking my call. Bye.
All right, great. That's a great question. Thank you so much. Let's hear next from Eric in Menlo Park. Hi, Eric.
Yes, I think we are dealing with an element of propaganda. I'm trying to harken back to your issue about 56% in survey. The problem is what survey? It's the distraction to justify some means and focus public attention elsewhere. The survey is way too general. What does it mean that 56% support surveillance? Do they support police in the street? Do they support the cameras in the street? The question being so general creates a very sloppy response segment. If you start asking and drilling down what happens to the data, how the data is being used, can the data be invoked, can you potentially pick your personal file, these matters start weighing in with more importance, and I would argue that the fraction and distribution of responses would be different. So as a propaganda tool, such surveys are very convenient to quote because it comes from a authoritative source, but at the same time, it's really meaningless, and we should do our homework, right? Our representative, read
yeah.
through the numbers.
Well, you raise a good point, because also, who knows how the question was asked, and in these surveys, they usually call about 1,000 people who still have landlines. And there is another one, a Gallup poll that came out and said 53% actually disapprove, and only 37% approve. So, I mean, who knows what the real percentage is? But, you know, I'll ask Heidi and Eli to comment on that because we do still have, we actually have a number of emails from listeners who say, why would people support this simply because they're not doing anything wrong? So thank you. You bring up a good point, Eric. Let's go next to George in San Francisco and then we'll get responses. Hi, George.
Hi, it's tempting to rephrase that old question having to do with the village and what you had to do to save it, that people weren't being asked how much of democracy they were prepared to destroy in order to save it. But the point that I raised with the screener wasn't that at all. Actually, what it is that now that the cat is out of the bag and Mr. Snowden has brought these questions out into the open, we might be careful not to lose ourselves in the weeds, because what it is tempting to do is to speculate on him and what are his motives. But the question could also be asked, why weren't the legislators discussing this? Where was the debate? And weren't legislators who were privy to these programs told that if they brought them to an open meeting, they would be arrested?
Right. Well, okay, so you raised some important questions there. And Heidi, Edward Snowden said the worst thing that could come from this is that nothing changes. What are your thoughts on that and just the response that you've seen so far? Are you surprised that there's not more response, that people aren't out in the streets saying, wait a minute, what is going on here? And I should say there are some small protests around the country.
There are some, but we're not seeing the kind of mass-scale outrage that we would hope we would. I think that it's useful to look at the structure of secrecy in this government right now. Information is being very carefully guarded by Obama. He has declassified far less information than previous administrations and at the same time classified many more millions of documents. So there is a strict control over what information is getting out to the public. He's punishing whistleblowers and leakers, really, more than any other administration has. And we're spying on AC has... The Associated Press has been spied on. Individual journalists have received subpoenas to get at their sources. So we have what seems to be a government a la Nixon that really wants to control what is in the mainstream press. And the press is increasingly run by a few large media conglomerates, corporate conglomerates. I think also it came out recently that top Obama appointees are using secret email accounts, allegedly to keep their inboxes from receiving too many unwanted messages. But the result of that is that when you file a Freedom of Information Act request, those communiques will not be made public. I think the reason our public seems to be not as outraged as we would hope is that they haven't been given the information that they need to be given. Their legislators are also kept in the dark, with the exception of a very few, and most of them are bound by so-called national security provisions that say they can't talk about it. So you have to, I think, look at the whole system of openness and control, which pervades the media, which is how most people get their information, and see that also in response to the question about whether our activists are being spied on, they are. The Department of Homeland Security was notifying businesses and local law enforcement well before Occupy started, calling them prospective terrorist threats. So when you call anyone who's an activist a prospective terrorist, you're sending a message that going out and speaking your mind is criminalized. I think those forces are having an insidious collective effect on the public conscience, and I think people are kind of numb right now to all of this.
Well, and also, what about the question about identifying groups, just quickly, Eileen's question?
I think that's definitely a possibility. It would surprise me if it wasn't, and I think, as Kurt mentioned earlier, they may not know the content of the message, but by association, who called whom, when, what geographic location, they can piece those things together.
And we have time for one more caller. Let's go to Steve in San Francisco. Hi, Steve.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks. We don't have much time, but go ahead.
Well, I think there's a lot of hysteria about this, and I'm really in favor very much that the government is doing this kind of surveillance. I don't have any problem whatsoever with them taking aggregate phone numbers and seeing if they connect up to some Al-Qaeda guy. I mean, it makes perfect sense to me, and I think there could be some real value in it. I mean, you can argue about the utility of it, but if indeed they're not listening into our phone conversation, I have no problem with that. I think it could be a fruitful way of sussing these people out.
Steve, what do you think about the monitoring, the calls and activity of average protesters?
Well, I don't think that's a good idea, of course. I don't think that's what most of this discussion is about. All this business, as far as I can see, is about this Bruce Hamilton guy talking about this kind of using computers to figure out who's talking to whom.
So the question is, where do you draw the line?
Well, that is a good question, and I don't have any problem with what I understand this activity to have been. I mean, I certainly I don't think that the government should, without warrants, be able to listen into phone conversations or check our emails and so on. But you know, good golly, you know, there are really bad people out there who really, really want to and have done really horrible things.
Well, let me get a response because we only have a minute left. Eli, what are your thoughts on Steve's comments?
Well, I mean, I think that this definitely is reflective of the national debate as well as a lot of the media coverage of it. There really is this portrayal of there being a trade-off that has to be made between security and privacy. And I think that obviously there are useful tools that the NSA has developed, and there are some things here that have application. The thing that is the most disturbing is that we are not seeing that there are adequate measures in place to protect people who are not under surveillance as being potential terrorists, who have not necessarily even had a court-ordered wiretap put on them. What we're seeing here, according to Snowden, is he says he can drop in on anybody's conversation. Well, he's a government contractor working for Booz Hamilton who can access anybody's phone records or even their communications. That seems like the safeguards were simply not in place, and I think that really it comes to a head when we look at the fact that when James Clapper, director of National Intelligence, was asked when he was testifying before Congress about whether domestic communications had been monitored, and he said no, and now he has had to walk that back and say that was the least untruthful answer. So we might be looking at a situation where the director of National Intelligence lied to Congress about surveillance.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We will definitely follow this. Steve, thank you for calling in. I'm sorry I had to cut you off, but we're out of time. Eli Clifton is a reporter covering these issues for the American Independent News Network. Heidi Boghossian is executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, author of Spying on Democracy, co-host of the radio show Law and Disorder on WBAI. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for your phone calls and emails. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar at Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll have a conversation about coverage of the NSA's surveillance program. How are the media treating Glenn Greenwald, the Guardian columnist who broke the story? And what about Edward Snowden, the 29-year-old who leaked the story? We'll also discuss coverage of the ongoing protests in Turkey. We'll be joined by the Open America Project's David Talbot, investigative journalist Tim Shorrock, and freelance journalist Justin Vella. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.